University of California Television presents this podcast of Presidential Accountability in War, or The Hippopotamus and the Butterfly, featuring Wade Sanders, former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Navy. This program was recorded at UC San Diego in September 2006 and is part of the Osher Lifelong Learning Series. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Hello, my name is Stanley Fair. I'm the president of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute from the campus of the University of California at San Diego. Osher Institute presents more than 30 classes each quarter. From literature, history, sciences and technology, foreign languages, music, and the arts. For further information, please visit our website at olli.ucsd.edu. Now it is my pleasure to introduce the coordinator of today's program from our distinguished lecture series, Al O'Brien.
It's an enormous pleasure to be here today because I not only introduce a very learned person, but a real American hero. There's a lot of controversy going on all over the world. Has the right thing been done? We have a San Diegan of quite renown, quite an enormous person. He's a graduate of USD Law School, Long Beach State, the Naval War College. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the Clinton administration. He's an ardent worker for Veterans Affairs. He's a man who was decorated with the Bronze Star, the Silver Star, and the Purple Heart. He ran those boats in the Mekong Delta. He's a man who faced fire, unlike some that we have in high elevated places, who had more things to do, or better things to do, or simply didn't show up, or abandoned their post entirely to work a political campaign in Alabama. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce San Diego's own war hero, an outstanding spokesman on military affairs for Channel 39, Wade Sanders.
Never let an Irishman introduce you. Well, I'm not a hero at all. I mean, I would say that I had the distinction and the honor to serve in the company of heroes. The men that supported me, the men I served with. And I want to tell you what a distinct pleasure and honor it is to be here. I really appreciate this opportunity. Al has been putting pressure on me for the last week about how important this was, and I knew it was important. And I hope that I prepared something for you that will be both entertaining and maybe stimulate some ideas and some conversation, because I really do appreciate a dialogue. I'm a great admirer of Will Rogers. I mean, I think the man was, and also, by the way, Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain, as he's known, people who look at the human condition and the condition of our society and seem to really nail it. And I think Rogers really nailed it. And if you think about this, this goes to the heart of what I'm really talking about, which is accountability and how we hold people in public office accountable. What is accountability? There it is, liable to being called to account, to answer, as opposed to responsibility, which is the price of accountability when you're called to answer. There may be responsibility. For instance, impeachment would be a form of responsibility because in the impeachment proceedings, the president is never called to testify. He or she is never placed under oath. They never really have to address the people of the United States. They are tried by the Senate. This is where I learned accountability. In the Mekong Delta of Vietnam, on a 50-foot aluminum patrol boat that was my baby, I had 6 enlisted men that I served with, but we really weren't officer and enlisted. We were really more of a family. And there is no unfortunate, it's an unfortunate way to learn accountability at its base level. but it certainly is graphic and extremely effective. As you can see, we operated in rather narrow canals. We thought of ourselves as targets, because that's essentially what we were. Now, the hippopotamus and the butterfly. When I was in the Navy Secretariat at the Department of Defense, you know, we often sat around and talked about accountability, because probably because we didn't want to be held accountable. There was this joke that was circulating around the Pentagon, which we, by the way, affectionately referred to as the five-sided puzzle palace, one of the largest lumps of concrete on the planet. And some people might say that the people who occupy that building occasionally are affected by that concrete. But in any case, one of the stories we would talk about was the hippopotamus and the butterfly. It seems that a hippopotamus and a butterfly came to the king of beasts, the lion, and his regalness was sitting on the throne, and the hippopotamus came with a butterfly to petition the king of beasts so that he may have the king of beasts' blessing on their marriage. Well, the king of beasts, of course, acknowledged the apparent problems that this marriage might create, but being the king of beasts, he granted them his blessing. Well, the next day in the morning, the hippopotamus appeared before the lion in tears, distraught. "Sir, your honor, your majesty, in the middle of the night I rolled over and I crushed my wife." And the lion looked at him and said, "Well, why are you coming to me? I only make policy." As far as I've been able to determine through my research, there really is no way to hold a president accountable, to answer. And this is George Bush's feeling on the issue of accountability, being called to answer. And you might look at this and say, what an incredibly arrogant statement to make, but it's not. It's an absolutely accurate statement. It could be made by any president at any time in the history of our country. Because as I mentioned before, impeachment isn't a remedy because it really isn't a trial. The president's not called to answer. Of course, he gives press conferences, but he really only answers the questions he wants to answer, or she will, if she's a president. But the bottom line is there's never any opportunity. But today, we are approaching the anniversary of a signal event in our history. It's not the anniversary of September 11th. That tragic day has passed. And it's not the creation of the universe, because as Bishop Usher told us, that would be October 23rd, 4000 BC. So, you know, that's coming up. And it's certainly not Pearl Harbor. We have that to look forward to. But what I'm referring to is October 16th, which is another date which will live in infamy. That was the date that marked the collapse of Enron. In that case, there was an accounting. There was a trial. Kenneth Lay and his cohorts, his colleagues, were called to answer before a court of law. And all of them were called to answer the charges against them, and there was justice meted out, although Kenneth Lay obviously appealed his to a higher power. Dr. Harlan Ullman, a friend of mine and also a columnist for that liberal rag, the Washington Times, once observed in his new book, he's got a new book out called America's Promise Restored, and what he does in that book, among other things, is he draws some interesting parallels between Ken Lay and between President Bush. Now, Ken Lay, there are three primary things that he did that really sort of created the collapse of Enron. I mean, there are many more, and this is a distillation of those particular things. But the parallels, I think, are really compelling, because Lay had this dream of creating the largest global market dominant power in financial transactions. And in doing so, he wagered the futures of thousands. Well, our present course of action has raised the stake to include lives as well as the future of nations. Mr. Lay's adventure was large, and the current adventure of this administration, which seems to be "we're democracy and here we come, ready or not," also carries with it tremendous implications. I think it's interesting to note that these two individuals had much more in common than their love of Texas cuisine. They also believed in staying the course, regardless of what was going on around them. And Bush, like Lay, told his shareholders, the American people, that he knew better, that he knows better, that he knows the right path, and even in the face of mounting contrary evidence, seems unwilling to be flexible or to change that course. There are three powerful, insightful, I think, and chilling parallels, which, given Mr. Bush's track record as a businessman and an entrepreneur, should cause both him and all of us to think differently about that course, especially in Iraq and the War of Terror. Like the president's grand strategy of Iraq today and the Arab Crescent tomorrow, Ken Lay determined to make, as I said, Enron the largest trading company on the globe. And like those who anticipated floral garlands in Baghdad, tens of thousands of Enron employees and shareholders eagerly embraced this, what they thought was a faster track to fame and fortune, not unlike a faster track to democracy in the Middle East. And to fuel his ambitions, what Ken Lay did is he relied upon what are called special purpose entities. And I'm not going to bore you with a lecture on what special purpose entities are. Just suffice it to say that these were financial vehicles that were set up specific partnerships and deals. And Bush's special purpose entity, of course, has been the United States military. And like the SPEs that Ken Lay created, our military grows hollower with each passing month as it's overextended. In the case of Enron's leadership, their reluctance to admit error and reevaluate their course was a recipe for disaster. In the case of the War on Terror, that same recipe is becoming disturbingly apparent, in my view. However, in both cases, their constituents, be they shareholders or voters, assumed that oversight was in place. But it wasn't in the case of Enron, and it collapsed like a house of cards. In the case of this administration and its grand plan, it's really difficult to tell what the future may hold for us. But so far, it isn't looking particularly good, unfortunately. Now, one could certainly argue that there are parallels between the three primary factors of the Enron collapse and the present state of affairs of our governance. And I don't believe in reading slides, so I think you've probably got through this already. But I want to show you just a quick look at how our president is doing. I obviously sort of took Ken Lay's three primary points and tried to adapt them to the present course of action with our foreign policy. And like I said, I will not read this to you. I think it's pretty clear. I mean, we had no reason, really, any compelling reason to go to war, and yet we did. In the process, we have misused and abused and stretched our military capability to the point now where it's really highly doubtful that we would be able to respond to any significant military threat to this country, at least as far as its external interests are involved. Unlike Enron and their colleagues like Adelphia and Peregrine, Quest, and Dynegy, WorldCom, Global Crossing, all these companies and many more that collapsed in the past 5 or 6 years, the president, even in time of war, as I pointed out and I'll reemphasize, is not called to answer. He never has to answer for or explain his policies or his decisions. He is above that in the executive branch, which is, as a sidebar, why congressional oversight is so vital. Because the people who founded this nation understood that no single arm of this government, be it legislative or executive, should be so superior to the other that they were not accountable to each other. But it could be argued that increasingly in these times, that is exactly what we're seeing. I want you to compare that with the military culture that I served in. Now, I didn't stay in the military and make it a full-time career, but the 3 years I spent in, and probably the way I was raised by my father, who was a career naval officer, the level of accountability is harsh. It's very unforgiving. And the reason why it is because of the stakes that are involved. In the military, even in peacetime, if you're commanding a ship or commanding a training exercise or a squadron of jets, if something goes really wrong, the first thing is the person who's in charge of whatever element that may be is going to be called to answer, either through a board of inquiry, a board of investigation, or hopefully not, a courts-martial. But there is a process by which an individual is placed under oath and has to answer. When I was a commanding officer, in the Navy. We used to say among ourselves, fellow commanding officers, that a collision at sea can spoil your whole day. And it can. It really will upset your lunch. Because we knew that a number of promising careers had foundered on the same shoals or rocks or whatever that, or another ship that our ship happened to run into. And it doesn't matter where you are as a commanding officer. The accountability is absolute. There are so many cases of commanding officers who weren't even there. For instance, Tailhook. There was a captain who had a promising career to be promoted. He didn't even go to Tailhook, but some of his people did, and they misbehaved. Well, not only did the people who misbehaved had to answer for their actions, this individual who wasn't even there, not even in the same state, was called to answer for the conduct of his men. Draw the parallel. Cabinet officers, president. That's also why I think, if you stop and think about it, that, you know, that's why commanding officers get medals. They're rewarded for the actions, the good things their people do, and they're punished for the bad things. Now, our presidents carry with them the title of commander-in-chief. Now, this is it's really an anachronism today. If you know the history of how that came about, it really came about because of George Washington, of course, who was a great fighting general. And actually, it was really some of the people who founded this country really thought that, like Caesar or Napoleon, the president of the United States would mount his white charger and lead our armies into battle. Literally. That was really the thought. And if you look at Washington, you can see why they might have held that belief, because clearly here was an impressive military figure. Now, but that's a vestige. It's an archaic nom de guerre. President Bush, with all due respect to him, obviously relishes this honorific. There has never been any other president in history who has used mass troops as a background for his statements with such regularity and frequency. Never before. When I served, I can speak from personal appearance, when I served in the Clinton administration, Clinton only really appeared with military people when he went to Arlington to lay a wreath at the grave of the unknown soldier, or was honored at a military base. But he did not give policy speeches with men and women in uniform standing behind him. No other president has done that, except this president, with such regularity. He's also the only president ever to wear a military uniform while president of the United States. Now, the conflict of interest there is inherent, but obviously he feels, I'm commander-in-chief, I can wear this uniform. Well, even President Eisenhower, a man you could say had a rather distinguished military record, was never, never wore a uniform. He was asked to wear his uniform on a number of occasions. He said, no, that would not be appropriate. That is not who I am today. Now, Ken Lay and President Bush, as I said, have many things in common. And that was his accountability to his shareholders. Well, I would argue that this president needs to be accountable to his shareholders, the voters of this country. Because for better or for worse, I mean, in a corporation, shareholders meet, what, annually usually? And they get together and they get to go at it with the CEO. Well, we have a quadrennial review, not unlike the quadrennial review that occurs in the Department of Defense. But that quadrennial review is called the election cycle. Every 4 years, there is a process by which one could say that the president's called to answer. He has to answer to the American people. He has to sell his program. He has to answer questions to be reelected. Well, I believe that the oversight that we have needed all this time, which is so sorely lacking because of our elected representatives' apparent kowtowing to this president and this administration and refusing to apply the vigorous accountability and oversight that's required. And also, I think that, as a sidebar, looking at the campaigns that are being conducted now, we have campaigns that are staffed by political operatives who feel the most effective way of defending their issues, from health care to confirmation of Supreme Court justice, is to use attack and negative ads. Well, I'm going to propose two pieces of legislation, and not one of them has a ghost of a chance, an ice cube, as we used to say, an ice cube's chance in hell of ever being passed. But I just think they're wonderful, because I thought, I didn't think of them, I probably stole them from somebody else, but we know that governance in our country is broken, whether it's accountability of the president or Congress applying appropriate oversight, and the constant bickering that goes on, I think sometimes way beyond what is necessary between, you know, between, I think, the, what do they call it, the loyal opposition and the party in power, beginning to be so personal in its direction and its attack. I think that what we need is a Sarbanes-Oxley law for our government. And for those of you who do not know what Sarbanes-Oxley is, it basically was a piece of legislation that was proposed after the collapse of Enron and WorldCom and other entities. Whoops, no we're not. Go back. Well, what the heck? Now you saw my ending. But anyway, the idea is to provide transparency. Otherwise, I think the erosion of faith and trust people, the trust that people place in our government is going to continue to erode even more seriously. Because at present, as I pointed out, we have an executive branch that holds itself above congressional oversight, and we have a Congress that's for sale to the highest bidding lobbyist in many cases, greed. So with a modified Sarbanes-Oxley, you take the essence of what Sarbanes-Oxley is, which is to provide transparency, accountability, and hold leadership in government responsible, to hold them to be called to answer, have rules laid out, not as to what they can say or how they can behave, but to show us what they're doing. And you see a little bit of this in the attempt to try to prevent these after midnight markups on congressional legislation. I'm not going to give you a civics lesson on this, but basically when a piece of legislation is going through the process of being passed, not only do we have a president who thinks it's appropriate to write on a passed piece of legislation his own comments as to how this legislation will be implemented, which raises some rather interesting constitutional issues. We have a Congress that thinks it's appropriate after hours when nobody's looking to mark up their bills, the budgets, to feed off money. Well, of course, every elected representative is responsible to their district, and I'm sure that even Democrats, I know that's hard to believe, but even Democratic legislators and Congress members take care of their own districts. And I don't think anybody really opposes that as long as it's in the best interest of all of us, if it serves a greater purpose. The second idea I have, which I think is much more entertaining, is, does anybody here watch Prime Minister's Questions? Now, I'm not suggesting that we adopt the entire parliamentary system and throw out a president just because he's no longer in the majority, although there have been times. But what I am suggesting is, what a wonderful way to provide a forum where a president has to answer tough questions. In the British system, for those of you who do not know, once a week, the Prime Minister of England has to appear before the House of Commons for 30 minutes. And there is it's structured. I mean, there are certain people, not certain people get to ask questions, but there are questions that are proposed. And if you've watched it, you can watch how, no matter what you think about an English Prime Minister, no matter what you might think about Majors or Blair or Thatcher, you will see people who are on their game, articulate, able to stand up and explain why they're doing what they're doing and what they want to do. We have nothing like that in our system. So I'm just picturing in my mind, don't go there yet, which presidents can you think of would have been capable of going to the House of Representatives once a week and standing up to questions from the opposition?
Clinton, Kennedy.
I think Nixon, let's be fair. Truman, yeah. Believe the present guy alone. But just think of the entertainment value here. And besides, But think of what it would produce. It would produce national leaders who can at least walk and talk at the same time, could chew gum and talk. I mean, could actually be able to be articulate and respond in the cauldron of that kind of. And that, my friends, I think breeds better core of leadership. I think that energizes people who are going to think about seeking public office or being president of the United States, and knowing I better be able to stand up and defend what I believe in. Because if I can't, I'm going to be on national television once a week making a fool out of myself. I think that would be very effective. And I also know that I don't think it has a ghost of a chance of working. But what it reminded me of was several years ago, after Poland became threw off the yoke of communist power under the leadership of Lech Walesa and the Solidarity Movement, there was a group of Polish legislators who came to the United States, and their purpose was to study the systems of democracy in our country and determine what they wanted to have in Poland. And I spent considerable time with this relatively young man who had spent 7 years in prison under communist rule before he was freed by the victory of the Solidarity Movement. And he said, and I said to him, I gave him this advice. I said, take a look at what we've got. Take a look at what we've got and look at the good and look at the bad. Because you have this incredible opportunity to make something new. Think what it would be like in this country if we had the opportunity to start over, to make our government relevant to today. Think of the implications. I'm not saying that's good. I'm not saying that's bad. What I'm saying is that as we go through our life, we should encourage our government to constantly look at itself and examine itself and to learn more ways to be answerable. Because what I'm afraid is that if we don't do that, then I'm afraid that we'll never be able to prevent the tragedy of the hippopotamus and the butterfly. Thank you so much.
I wonder if you would comment on the evolution of George Bush. When he first became president, we all thought he would not be able to handle press conferences. But to be fair and balanced and objective, don't you think he's improved as far as answering the public and answering the press and handling interviews?
I find that criticism of him for his disjointed speaking style and some of the malapropisms that he utilizes, I think there's a great deal of evidence to support that he has perhaps a form of dyslexia or some other sort of situation that makes it very difficult for him to be able to communicate. Having said that, I try to ignore the stumblings in his favorite word, which appears to be and just try to look at the substance of what he's saying. And I also try to be not critical of him because I happen to be more liberal than he is. I'm sorry, I'm a lawyer, so I charge by the minute. But I think what I'm trying to say is that the thing that I've noticed about what's going on right now, and I'll get to your question, is that when I was in the Clinton administration and President Clinton behaved in what I think was an absolutely abhorrent fashion while he was in office. You know, you could have a debate of whether, you know, anybody died as a result of what happened in the Oval Office, as opposed to people are dying now. You can talk about, I think, proportionality. But the reality was to be in that administration at that time was, quite frankly, personally embarrassing. It was very, very embarrassing, and it made it very difficult for me to do my job because of that. Because, you know, I drew all my power as a presidential appointee from the person who appointed me. Now, I will be quite frank with you and tell you that no, I don't think the substance. I think he's gotten better. He's been heavily coached, as he should be, as many public officials are. He's gotten much better in his ability to be able to deliver his message. But I still do not find I find very little about his message compelling, supported by the historical record, by the cultural record of the region, and by where we want to go as a country.
You mentioned the military subculture, and I'm an Army brat, so I understand that a little bit. My greatest disappointment has been in Colin Powell. And when he was Secretary of State, was he so engrossed in being a retired general that he could not go against his commander-in-chief? I would love to hear your take on his reaction to this war.
Well, I've had the pleasure to meet the general on a number of occasions. I will not say that I'm a close personal friend of his, but I do have those who are very close personal friends of his. And he has expressed after, the core of your question is, let me get to that first. As a retired general, he came from an institutional culture where he was used to taking orders and following those orders, being a good soldier, quote unquote. And even though I know from conversations, not with him directly, but with people who have had direct conversations with him, that he viewed the time in the Bush administration as one of the most disappointing and saddest years of his life. He felt honor-bound, since he was serving his president, his commander-in-chief, to not necessarily knuckle under, because he didn't. I know Rich Armitage, the deputy, because I've known Rich since Vietnam, when I thought he was the man with the largest upper body I'd ever seen on one human being. Brilliant man, caring man, several adopted children of different races. If he ever ran for president, I'm sure Karl Rove would have fun with that, as he did with John McCain. But yes, he was a loyal soldier, but he felt betrayed by the intelligence that he was given. He feels betrayed by his testimony that he gave before the United Nations. So yes, he's not a happy guy about it. But he would not, while he was in that office, he worked very hard to try to change things. I mean, for instance, a friend of mine that I served with in SWIP boats, who will remain nameless, actually was a key player in developing the plan after the invasion, which called for far more troops because there was a recognition within the Department of State, set aside whether we should have gone. I mean, that's another debate. But there was a recognition within the Secretary of State's office and within Colin Powell that we had to secure the environment. If we didn't secure the environment immediately, we would be dealing with chaos. And remember what Powell said, if you break it, you own it? Well, that's exactly what happened. This incredibly detailed plan for after the invasion was basically thrown into a wastebasket by George Bush and Condi Rice and Donald Rumsfeld. And from that point on, really after the invasion, Colin Powell became irrelevant as a Secretary of State, at least as far as his ability to be able to impact the troika, or actually more than a troika, of Richard Pearl, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice. And Dick Cheney. How can we forget Dick Cheney? So I probably took too long on that question, but the answer is yes, he was a good soldier.
I have a question which the entire nation is facing. How do we get out of this mess in Iraq?
Well, I think probably what's going to happen is that if wars are driven by political will. I mean, they're not often. There are some wars that have been driven which were driven by more honorable or legitimate purposes. But wars of choice are always wars that are driven by political will. Vietnam, Korea, and the present situation in Iraq. Desert Storm was not a war that was driven by political will. It was driven as a result of defending a particular piece of territory. This war, being a war of choice, makes it very difficult to sustain. You can see that the will of the American people has already turned against this war. I would not want to be on the field as a soldier in this war. I mean, I would be, in all wars, as I was on my SWIFT boat. When I came back from Vietnam, I demonstrated against the war, and because I felt that it was wrong-headed and the wrong policy. But while I was there, I did my job, and I made sure that I and my, especially my men, as many of them I could, I brought home alive. That was my number one job. I wasn't concerned about politics, and the soldiers in Iraq are not concerned about politics. What do we do? Well, as Powell said, we broke it, now we own it. But what I think this administration will do, if the political will of the people continues to sour, They will figure out a way to declare victory and get out. I mean, they will. They did it in Vietnam, and which was another sort of wrong-headed war in my view. And they'll do it in Iraq. They'll declare victory and leave the Iraqi people to the way it is now. And quite frankly, I don't see how they would be better or worse off if we left tomorrow. What would be worse off, and I really don't know how much weight to give this, is what would that do to our reputation in the world? There's this bugaboo that somehow or another that would make us seem weak and ineffective and everything else, but there's another point of view that says it would see that we're smart enough to know when we're in a hole and we'll get out of it. What's going to happen in the best possible scenario, I believe, even under this president, is they're going to have to come to a point where they're going to hold the Iraqi government to account themselves, to become responsible in the best way they can, and we're going to start withdrawing our troops to outside the country, because being in these little enclaves, as we did in Vietnam, is no more effective than it was in Vietnam, because you see what happens when you leave the enclave. Every 40 minutes, there's an attack against Americans, and most of those attacks are happening on the highways, whereas I was in my Swift boat, these guys in their Humvees and gals in their Humvees and trucks are nothing more than targets and training opportunities.
Could we switch to the local scene for a moment, not too much time? What's your evaluation of what's going on in the city of San Diego? And do you think Mike Aguirre is a force for good or a force for bad?
You're asking me to put my reputation. I mean, I live in this town. I think Mike Aguirre.
A little profile and courage, Dan.
Yeah? Well, I've never been accused of having a lot of judgment in that area. Not courage, but speaking my mind. I happen to be a great admirer of what Mike Aguirre is trying to do. I think that obviously he could use, and I'll be quite balanced in remarks, I think he could use a little work on his style. But, you know, he's a pit bull. And he went after some tough problems, and I think he probably felt it was necessary to attack them in a very tough way. Sometimes there's a time for civil dialogue, and sometimes you need somebody to stand up and say that, you know, there's a fire in the house. And Mike Aguirre certainly did that. I think that our political leadership in this town, I wish it had a little more backbone in a way. We really need to have a mayor, and maybe Jerry Sanders will rise to this. You know, my concern about people who have come up through institutional environments, whether it's, you know, once again, it can be a concern with the Navy or the Marine, or rather the military, or corporate life, is that usually to go to the highest places in those areas requires a person who doesn't make waves, does not create controversy, and basically knows how to get along with everybody. Well, those are admirable traits. But when you're looking at crisis in the face, sometimes you need to have the kind of person where you break glass and let them out, and then round them up after the problems are solved and put them back in the cage. I think we probably needed a mayor who came out saying that I'm only going to be here for one term. I'm going to make some tough decisions. The people of San Diego are going to be angry with me. But we got a problem, and we got to address it rather than putting it off. There's an awful lot of concern about political futures involved in this. This is all natural. There's nothing malignant about this or unexpected. I mean, it's Jerry Sanders would probably like to serve two terms. And, you know, if he makes too much noise, he may not get a second term. So long and the short of it is I probably have said too much. I do respect Jerry Sanders. I respect Ronnie Froman. I worked with her when she was a captain in the Navy and watched her make flag. But I think we need our present leaders, to stop being so politically correct and really look at the problems and solve them, and to reach out to people like Pat Shea and some of the other people who had, I thought, some pretty good ideas about not putting off the pain, getting it over with, and moving on the same way Orange County did. So I think we need political leadership, I think, with courage. I think we need political leadership at all levels, for the presidency all the way down to local government, that people that aren't afraid to stand up and say things that aren't entirely the most popular things to say and don't always take the most popular positions. I mean, I think we need political leadership that's a little less concerned about the next re-election cycle and a whole lot more concerned about what they can do while they're in office.
Why can't we, or the Democratic Party and its leadership, develop a program of rapid response to claims that are made rather than waiting so long and letting those claims become almost reality?
Well,
the question particularly I'd like to ask you with your Swift Boat experience.
Yeah, I was going to go there.
You know, I personally think it wasn't the 60,000 votes in Ohio. I think it was the Swift Boat misrepresentations that came on and on and on.
Well, you're not alone.
With no response.
Okay, I got the question. I was in the middle of that. I was one of John Kerry's band of brothers. I was on stage with him and had the honor to be introduced to the American people along with the 12 other people who served with him and on his or on his boat. I happen to have my own Swift boat, which I constantly remind Senator Kerry. I always remind the senator that my boat was prettier and faster than his. But to take a serious note, it was, I mean, I was in on that from the very beginning. And quite frankly, the campaign, I think the campaign leadership let down the senator. They didn't understand or appreciate the impact of having people, even if they didn't serve at the same time or with the senator himself, were in the same units. People don't have a tendency to parse those things very carefully. So you had a group of 18 people, and that's all there were in the beginning. There were 18 people, and there were only about 12 of them that were ever visible. And they claimed to have many more. They claimed to have, they've got 177 people who signed up to get John Kerry to release his military records, and 3,500 of us served in Swift Boats. I could spend an hour talking about this. I will not do that to you. What I will say is you're absolutely right. If John Kerry had run his presidential campaign in the first 8 months of his candidacy, as he did in the last three, he'd be president of the United States now. Because beginning, if you remember, September and October were terrific months. He brought in James Carville, the Raging Cajun. He worked with, I think it's Joe or John Sasso. He brought in people who understood that you can't allow anything to lie on the table for more than about an hour, for no time at all. And not only that, you lean forward and attack. You don't wait for them to come to you. But after the first Swift Boat ad came out and got national play, there was almost a three-week delay before anything was done. And that was as fatal as the failure of the United States to have adequate troops to secure the environment in Iraq. You can't allow, nature abhors a vacuum, and a vacuum was allowed to occur.
I want to go to your military experience. One of the problems of most countries are they prepare to fight the last war. And that was very definitely obvious on this one. And it would have required a great deal more study, as you mentioned in your talk, to really understand the world where we were jumping into. But I'm concerned now in the effects of the war on the economic situation of this country. Because as I read it, we have increased the federal debt to an incredible level. We've undercut parts of our tax system. We're running a debt in public and private debt on a very...
Right.
I'm concerned that we've done what many other countries have done, the big empires and so forth, mm-hmm. overextended ourselves in peripheral wars that drain away our strength. So I don't see us as stronger now. I see us incredibly weaker.
And your question, please.
Well, do you agree with that? Do you think it's that kind of serious?
Well, I think first of all, we weren't prepared. We weren't prepared to fight this war, and that wasn't because we were prepared to fight the last war. The reality is that beginning in the Reagan administration, regardless of what you might hear from people who don't understand and never served in the Department of Defense as I did in a position of somewhat senior leadership, is that we were beginning with Reagan after the wall came down and continuing through Bush 1 and continuing through Clinton, we were going through a radical reconfiguration of the military. We were going to rely much more heavily on reserves, and we were going to tailor down the size of our manpower force because no one ever anticipated. We were trying to develop a military that was going to be rapid, fast, and surgical. Get in, kick ass, get out. Or as the Marines like to say, we're the 911 force. We're going to kick the door in, clean up the room, and leave. There was never, ever, ever any anticipation that we would be engaged in a multi-year occupation. We were not configured for that. We configured our forces to rely heavily on the reserves because we knew that the mistake we made during the Vietnam War was there really was no draft. There was a draft, but I mean there was no mobilization of the reserves. All these inexperienced people were not drawn upon. When you draw upon the reserves, you bring in Mary and Sue and Ralph and Tom from all over America, from their jobs into the military, fresh blood, fresh ideas, and a sense of ownership of the conflict that does not exist in this country today, but even because it was too late. I mean, what happened was is we never anticipated this kind of an occupation. You know, we're burning out our reserves. We're hollowing our force. We're breaking our army. We're not breaking the Navy, because the Navy is a player, but obviously not the extreme player. But the Marine Corps and the Army and the Air Force are in deep trouble. Deep trouble for enlistments, deep trouble for manpower, and the National Guard and the reserves are really suffering, particularly the National Guard. They were never intended to be going back for 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 rotations. We were supposed to get in, like I said, kick ass, take names, go home.
Over here.
My question is this: what do you think about Bush's policy towards Iran?
Well, I think I kind of touched on that. I think that, you know, there should be a dialogue between, because all you do when Bush sets himself, or any president sets himself up as being the positive pole to the Antichrist, what you do is, you, even though the people of Iran, who I know from my experience with people who have been there, really do want a more democratic form of government. They really don't like what they've got, but they're in a spot. But what always happens when you attack the leadership of a country, no matter how abysmal that person might be or how hated they might be by their own people, he's theirs. And so what Bush has done is he's, listen, if the president of Iran has become far more popular now, and he could not have asked for a better public relations man than George Bush. I mean, he has, there's a saying that you are measured by the stature of your enemies. Iran suddenly finds themselves in the crosshairs of the United States and the leader of the most powerful nation on the world. What does that do for his stature within his country? Suddenly he's a superstar.
What happens if Bush maintains his stance that he will not talk?
Well, what will happen if he does not talk is there's no dialogue, and if there's no dialogue, things just continue to get worse. And you put yourself in a corner, and you put yourself in a corner where maybe only military action becomes your only option. I mean, you so limit your options when you're not willing to dialogue. And I'm not saying that you have to that everybody is worthy of a dialogue and you dialogue with everybody. But when you're dealing with the leader of a country, even though you may not agree on anything, at least you have a conversation going about it.
Well, the old ladies are quarreling back here, but my question has to do with the national debate that we're having both on a national level, upper level, and among ourselves regarding torture. You have a background both as an attorney and in the service. This is an area that, although a lot of us don't fight on a battlefield, we have to come to face-to-face with this kind of issue. And it's very difficult.
Well, every acknowledged expert will tell you that torture doesn't work. It's a sloppy, ill-thought-out, non-productive way of obtaining information. I mean, it really is. I mean, there's no credible dispute about that. So why this president thinks it's important to be able to waterboard, his attorney general who legalized it, Alberto Gonzalez. It's a mystery to me, because every military leader that I know of repute or respectability abhors the idea of using torture, because for no other reason, if you do it, they'll do it. And the idea, and you'll hear this argument that people said about, you know, Abu Ghraib, well, that wasn't so bad. I mean, they weren't being beheaded. Well, you know, in a way, if you're a Muslim, well, let's put it in our terms. If you were a Catholic or a Christian, and you were required to do things to a crucifix that a crucifix was never intended to do, I think that would be outrageous. And you would think it was outrageous. Well, that is what they were doing in Abu Ghraib, in a sense. You don't get information that way. All you do is tarnish yourself. And I don't need to beat this horse to death. It's clear that it's wrong. I know the Geneva Conventions. I've spoken about the Geneva Conventions. I think they're fine. They're clear. They came about because of well-reasoned thought and a lot more experience than this administration has in dealing with people who are prisoners of war or prisoners, period. I think it's a disgrace. I think what's going on in Guantanamo is a disgrace. I think the secret prisons are a disgrace. Gonzalez deports a guy to Jordan, who then deports him to Syria, a country we're supposed to hate, so that he can be kept in a dungeon and tortured for a year. And his only crime is somebody put him on a list. I don't get it.
Next question. It's been mentioned several times that this is not a representative sample of people who live in, say, North County. When you speak to people, say a group of people who primarily watch Fox News and watch Fox News only, what type of impression do you make on them?
They haven't invited me yet. I mean, I'd be delighted to talk to them if they want to have a reasoned debate and be able to be flexible in their thinking as I am willing to be in mine. You can't really have a debate with an ideologue. It's like trying to convert a Baptist to Catholicism or a Jew to Christianity. Some people hold their political beliefs so deep within who they are that to question that is questioning themselves. And in a way, I think that's very sad. And clearly, it's good to have strong values and really believe in what you believe in. But to make them so inflexible that you cannot think of another way of looking at any topic, I think it eliminates so much of what is so joyful about life. I mean, it's all part of this adventure of learning things about yourself. And I'm constantly questioning what I believe, and I'm always willing to really believe that what George Bush is doing in Iraq is great. I just haven't been able to find any sort of logic to support that. And I've read all the, I don't just read, all these books that are coming out now as people decide it's okay now to go after the president. Where were they 4 years ago? Thank goodness, I'm glad Bob Woodward finally wrote a book, but he should have written it 5 or 6 years ago. I can think about different ideas, and I read the other side. I read the conservative. I read the National Review. I read, It's hard for me. It's hard for me to read Ann Coulter, but I do because she has something to say, and there might be something in there that might be of value to me. I haven't found it yet, but it might be there.
The word terrorism hasn't been mentioned today, and I wonder if you would . There's a debate that's going on. Are military solutions the approach, or should they be political solutions? What do you think of the extent of terrorism, its definition, and what we ought to do about it?
Well, clearly, a military response to terrorism can be appropriate. I was struck by what George Bush said after 9/11. One of the first things he told the American people was to go shopping. And that was viewed as a statement of strength. John Kerry, on the other hand, John Kerry, on the other hand, said, it would be a better thing if we tried to understand why the only way these people thought they could have a dialogue with us was to fly airplanes into buildings. And that's considered to be weak. Understanding, I don't get this in the military, when I was in Vietnam and I was in combat, I wanted to understand my enemy. I want to know what kind of weapons they had. I want to know how they employed them. And I want to know how to best react to them. And I also want to know what made them, why were they doing this? What was the core of their struggle? The smart people, I think, understand that grinding poverty, political corruption, and a sense of hopelessness are high on the list of why people do these things. I mean, the idea of strapping on, explosives and immolating yourself or eviscerating yourself in that violent way and believing that it's a good thing, why do you think that way? What are we doing? What could we do to maybe alleviate that, to identify and address the issue that motivates that? So that, I think, is a far better way of approaching terrorism. I think that you obviously have two prongs to it. You have to defend yourself. But if you think that what goes on at the airports today is protecting you, that I don't want to shatter your palace, but Homeland Security, the TSA, well-meaning people at TSA are not stopping any more stuff going through than they did before they were there. And if you think sniffer dogs are effective, then I'll tell you something. After they get their first whiff of perfume, they're done for the day. It's all about show. It's all about to make the people who are flying in the airplanes feel safe. If you really wanted to be absolutely safe in an airplane, you would have to put up with the kind of measures that are applied by the gold standard, which is El Al. I mean, you want to get on an airplane out of Israel, that's a whole different idea. But their airplanes are, and by the way, they screen all their baggage. So I mean, it's all show and tell. It has no real effect in preventing terrorism. And when Condi Rice said to the nation, we never thought anybody would fly an airplane in a building, and I was part of the Oklahoma City bombing, a study on weapons of mass destruction, and that report we put out, and that was almost 8 years before. We talked about airplanes flying into buildings, and we also talked about people strapping explosives on themselves and walking into airline terminals on holidays and detonating themselves in the ticket area. You don't have to go through security. Just walk, park your car, get out, walk in, detonate. I mean, the bottom line is the best statement I've ever heard about terrorism was a guy who was running the Utah Olympics, and he said, we can't prevent it. We can't prevent anybody who really wants to die. There is no real defense against it. So why are we abrogating our civil rights? Why are we ruining our lives in reaction to what is really, really a relatively low number of people who are willing to do that to us and to get here and do that? It's not because of what George Bush has been doing or what Bill Clinton did. The reality is it's not easy to do. And I think proportionality in how we react to these kinds of acts and terrorists is as important as eliminating the terrorists themselves.
Wade, I speak for many. You have taken us to the mountaintop today.
Yeah.
Wonderful. You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.